And in New Orleans, the historic Roosevelt Hotel is back, 4 years after Hurricane Katrina left 10 feet of water in its basement. The Roosevelt is a landmark. Louisiana's iconic governor Huey Long used to hang out there. The building's $145 million renovation is seen as a bright spot in the city's revitalization efforts. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
The hotel dates back to 1893, but back in the 1920s and 30s, the Roosevelt was the place to stay in New Orleans.
I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow, got a string on my finger. What a world, what a life. I'm in love.
Jazz greats, including Louis Armstrong, performed in the Blue Room, and movie stars frequented the Grand Hotel. After being shuttered for nearly 4 years, the Roosevelt has regained its former brilliance.
Probably, I guess these are 20-foot ceilings, and you've got gilded columns all the way down the lobby.
Mark Wilson is director of sales and marketing for the Roosevelt, now part of the Waldorf Astoria chain of hotels. Original mosaic tiles in the lobby were uncovered, and the Italian crystal chandeliers have been carefully cleaned. Now they are stunning.
The property did not suffer flooding in the lobby. It was really in the basement areas where it's mechanical equipment. So this area here was in relatively good shape, but it has been restored meticulously, and we're really excited to bring it back to the community.
In the Sazerac Bar, PJ Hanna, in his 20s, mixes the famous cocktail this place was named for. It's made with whiskey, bitters, simple syrup, and a hint of licorice.
Here's your Sazerac.
Hanna was a bartender and cook before Katrina. He left New Orleans but returned a year ago and was one of thousands who applied for 350 positions at the hotel. Hanna could work anywhere in the country, but he came back because he says he missed the culture and entertainment.
It dawned on me one day, it's like, the city's not going to rebuild itself. It needs people. We need to, like, you know, get in there. So I was just like, all right, I'm coming back, you know.
It's just been an amazing transformation to see it become what it is today.
Terry Truding relocated to Philadelphia after the storm because the hotel she had been working for was closed. But she returned a year later and ultimately applied here.
I just got so excited about the possibility of it and that this whole block needed to be regenerated and rejuvenated. And this was the first step to really getting this whole area back.
Part of the lure of this hotel comes from former Louisiana Governor Huey Long, known as the Kingfish. Long was ruthless, corrupt, and gained massive political power. He built thousands of miles of roads, one leading right to a suite at the Roosevelt Hotel. Long even wrote a song to appeal to the masses.
Every man a king, every man a king, for you can be a millionaire.
According to the legend, Huey Long kept a cash box known as the deduct box inside his hotel suite. It was his political slush fund. Many believe he kept it hidden in a wall here, but the box has never turned up, even with this latest renovation.
I mean, there's a lot of colorful things that may or may not have happened in this room, but the deduct box and the money that may have been here, we sure haven't been able to find it.
What the city has found is something to rally around and another economic engine. Kelly Schultz is with the Metropolitan Convention and Visitors Bureau.
We have major conventions that come to the city. They can, you know, rent out entire restaurants and ballrooms in the hotel. And if you think about that, that also creates a lot of economic impact with the, you know, bringing in florists and AV companies and transportation companies and all the other things that go along with just the hotel rooms and the meeting space, and all the better that we can employ even more people in New Orleans hospitality industry.
In my mind, it's another check on the list that we're off the resuscitation, you know.
Ben Johnson is with the New Orleans Chamber of Commerce. Many areas of the city are struggling. In fact, vacant buildings and the still-closed Orpheum Theater occupy the same block where the Roosevelt sits. But Johnson says things are turning around.
The Roosevelt, in my mind, is a positive example where investors are putting a lot of money with the idea of a big return, and it's very good for New Orleans to have that hotel back.
Even in the midst of a recession, the hotel with its 500 luxury rooms and ultimately 500 new jobs is bringing in customers who are spending money in shops and restaurants. But so many here say the rebirth of the Roosevelt is a psychological boost for this recovering city. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
For more on this trend, we turn to retail analyst Howard Davidowitz. He says layaway has some advantages for the consumer.
It is a very good program as long as you can make the final payment. If you can't, you will forfeit the money that you paid.
Hmm.
And there may also be an additional $10 fee. So that, yes, it is a very good deal. It's growing in a few areas. It's really not that big. There is a site, eatlayaway.com, that claims they're doing very well, and 1,000 retailers are participating. At the end of the day, there's really only about 7 or 8 retailers doing layaway in a big way. Most retailers have actually stopped doing layaway.
Why?
It wasn't economical for the retailer. Because, see, the retailer has got to take the merchandise, take it off the floor, put it into a stock room. It's all this handling, processing. The customer comes in, pays $3 every week. It was a messy business. Most retailers, by the way, including Walmart, did not find it profitable and gave it up. Right now, Walmart does not do layaway, only on jewelry only.
And yet, from what I understand, a company like Kmart actually has a huge increase in people doing layaway on small ticket items.
That's absolutely right. But if you look at Kmart, they're a train wreck. They're closing stores. So if you look at who's doing this, I mean, that may tell you something. I don't want to say it's an act of desperation. Let's put it this way. Very few of the top retailers are doing it. Of course, you got TJ Maxx, Marshalls. They're very good operators. They're doing it. But yes, it does show the desperation and weakness on a part of the American consumer.
I can understand people, you know, putting down $50 this week, $50 next week for a big ticket item like a refrigerator. But when you're talking about pens and pencils, something that costs a few dollars.
Let's talk about it, and let's talk about the reality of half of America. We're in a bifurcated society. Now, if the kid needs a pair of denim and a pair of sneakers to go back to school, that becomes a crisis. It's important to get the sneakers because he's got to have them. He doesn't want to look terrible. So that couple of dollars means everything.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, typically when people don't have money for a small item that they want to buy, they just put it on their credit cards. You're saying things are so bad that a credit card is no longer even an option for many people.
What it says is the consumer is under enormous stress. The consumer can't pay their credit card debt. Consumer bankruptcies are going through the roof. They can't pay their student loans, their auto loans. In fact, consumers have cut back on using their credit cards because their lines are being cut back. So the consumer is cutting back using credit cards. And if you're out of money and you're out of credit, layaway is a way to get something.
Howard Davidowitz is a retail analyst in New York City. Thank you.
You're welcome.
To survive the recession, thousands of businesses have done the same thing, cut jobs. But one small-town factory is trying something different. Instead of cutting employees, it's putting them to work on jobs that were once done by outside contractors. From member station WIUM in Macomb, Illinois, Rich Egger reports.
Bushnell is a small farm community of about 3,300 situated in western Illinois. It's located between the Mississippi and Illinois rivers, about an hour and a half drive from the Quad Cities. You won't find any chain stores in its downtown, but there is a small cafe, a furniture store, some law offices, and a few small factories. At the north end sits a big red brick building. It's the home of Midwest Control Products, a company that makes ball joints, rod ends, and other metal products for the ag and trucking industries. And lately, this company has become known for one of its innovations.
We're trying to do something different that is self-sufficient.
Kerry Rhodes is the company's vice president.
And we're making it work. And we'd like to see other more people take an approach like that instead of creating spending programs.
Instead of laying off any of its 68 workers, the company set up what it calls an alternative work program. Employees here now do maintenance work that the company used to contract out. They're cleaning offices, tuck-pointing the brick, painting the factory, and repairing the machinery.
The fellow that took charge of doing all the ceiling painting, he has a sideline business as a house painter, but he's a welder for us. He was happy to do something different and in something that he enjoys doing.
Well, a lot of factory work is sort of repetitive, so in a way this is really giving the employees a chance to sort of break the routine, maybe break the monotony.
They really like that. I mean, they probably express that as much as anything, is that it's fun to do something different. And especially this time of year when the weather's nice, a lot of it they get to go outside.
Going outside means working in the company's two-acre garden, situated behind its other factory on the edge of town. Jason Garzi normally works as a press operator here, but on this breezy and cool summer day, he's digging weeds.
It works for me. I ain't laid off, so as long as we're staying busy, we got jobs and paycheck. Works for me.
Corn and tall sunflowers line one edge of the garden. Small, hand-painted wood signs mark the spots where you can find tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, and the like. Workers also spend some time selling the produce.
$4 a dozen. You get a baker's dozen. More 40 cents a piece.
Okay.
Drill press operator Tracy Howell is at the farmer's market in nearby Macomb. Today she's selling corn from the bed of a silver and black Ford Explorer.
There you go.
Thank you.
Howell likes this innovative program because it keeps her working.
It makes you feel like the company's actually thinking about the employees and not just making a quick buck.
By thinking this way about its workers, Midwest Control Products was able to stabilize its finances. In fact, Carrie Rhodes says it's remained profitable every month during the recession. Rhodes won't worry, though, if orders remain slow during the third quarter. He says there's still a long list of alternative work projects for workers to complete. For NPR News, I'm Rich Egger in Macomb, Illinois.
Economist Tim Harford has been on this program before, talking about, well, the kinds of things we often talk to economists about, investments, markets, banks, and so on. But in his Financial Times column, Dear Economist, Harford answers questions about things one wouldn't ordinarily put to an economist, like parenting, dating, and social etiquette. He has collected those questions, along with his answers, in a new book called Dear Undercover Economist, Priceless Advice on Money, Work, Sex, Kids, and Life's Other Challenges. Tim Harford joins us from the BBC in London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so why should I care what an economist has to say about something like whether a husband should put down the toilet seat for his wife?
Well, sometimes because the answers are fun. There is a certain irony in economists who, of course, have, you know, the least developed emotional register of any social scientist, you know, giving dating advice. But also sometimes the advice seems to be quite good. I mean, I know I'm the person giving the advice, but actually it doesn't feel like I'm really the person giving the advice. It feels like my evil twin is giving the advice, the person who, you know, doesn't care, you know, how rude he is or how much he cuts through the emotional complexities.
Let's take an example, if we could. Do you have a copy of the book there?
I do, yes.
Okay, let's turn to page 62, and I will read the question and you can read the answer, all right?
Sure.
Dear economist, I'm experiencing the strains of being in my senior year. This semester alone, I need to complete 7 projects and assignments, work on my dissertation, and sit 5 exams. I am the captain of the karate club, which requires a big time commitment, and I'm applying for jobs, which means lots of interviews and assessment days in the next few months. There aren't enough hours in the day. How do I prioritize my tasks effectively? Derek, via email.
Dear Derek, clearly you're not an economics student, or you would have already solved the linear programming problem necessary to optimize your allocation of time. Let me instead give you a couple of pointers. First, your time is spent investing rather than consuming. Sitting exams and applying for jobs will expand your consumption set in the future. Under the circumstances, it would be reasonable to borrow. You can borrow a little time for the future with the help of stimulants, but a more practical solution is to borrow money to save time. Quit any part-time job, take taxis, hire a cleaner, order takeout. This will save time and you can deal with the cost later when you've secured one of those precious jobs. More fundamentally, look for opportunities to gain from trade. Your karate appears to be an area of comparative advantage, so perhaps you could persuade some clever weakling to write your dissertation for you. In exchange, you could beat up at the boyfriend of the girl he's been lusting after. 5 minutes of applied karate practice for you would be a life-transforming experience for your assistant, well worth many days of work on your dissertation. Capitalism is not always pretty. Yours in search of gains from trade, the undercover economist.
Okay, so in that one piece of advice, you have recommended that this fellow take drugs, cheat on his dissertation, and beat up some guy.
Yeah, well, as I said, it's my evil twin. I'm channeling my pure inner economist. Now, I would never personally give that kind of advice, but that is the advice that economic theory suggests. There's no consideration in morality. It's all about what are the advantages open to you, what are the options, and how can you take the maximum advantage for yourself.
And so is this mostly about amusement, or is it actually useful for people to understand these principles as applied to the normal interactions of daily life?
Recently, for the Financial Times, I went back and I asked some of my correspondents whether I had actually given them useful advice or not. And some of them wrote back with, fairly comical answers. You know, they thought, well, my answer was fun. They gave me a fun answer back. But there were people who took the advice and they thought the advice was very good. So it's fun. Mostly I would put a health warning on the advice that the economist gives. But, every now and then, believe it or not, economics can make the world a better place.
You say that economics is remarkably well suited to the agony genre in this book. What do you mean by that?
I think it's the ability of economists to discard all the complications. Economics is all about trying to compute the rational strategy, the optimal strategy. So it's a little bit like getting dating advice from, say, Mr. Spock from Star Trek. But also, economists are also studying, why and when people depart from that rational strategy. So you've got this combination of a psychologist or a psychiatrist and a robot, and they're both giving you advice at the same time. And I think that appreciation of what the ideal strategy is and also the mistakes people so often make and the reasons they fail to find the ideal strategy, you've actually sometimes got a pretty powerful set of tools to give answers to even problems like, should I get a bikini wax?
So early in our conversation, I mentioned the economist's view of whether a husband should put the toilet seat down for his wife. And I'm sure many spouses listening to this conversation are dying for the answer to the question. What is it?
Well, there's a mathematical answer and there's a big picture answer. So the mathematical answer is, if you want to minimize the number of times somebody has to move the seat up and down, okay, which is, I think, the straightforward efficiency question here, then the optimal rule is everybody should just leave the seat the way they needed it. So if they needed to sit down, don't bother to put it up. If you needed to put it up, don't bother to put it down. Because, the man in the house might leave it up and then he might be the next person to use the lavatory. And so he might still want to, have it up. So that's the efficiency consideration. But in my advice, I said, there's a bigger picture here. And one of the things we always need to consider is, the messages that we are sending with our actions. As economists are all about not, what do you say, but what do you do? And it's a very, very cheap signal that shows consideration for a man to leave the lavatory seat down. Even if it's actually not the most efficient thing to do, he's actually showing that he's considerate, he's a gentleman. And funnily enough, about 6 months ago, my wife actually said to me, Tim, I really appreciate the fact you always put the lavatory seat down. I notice, as your friends come around, they don't always do it, but you always do it. And I really appreciate that. So, there you go.
And you replied, it's cheaper than flowers.
Exactly. Flowers are so expensive these days. This is a very cheap way of showing that you care.
Tim Harford is on the editorial board of the Financial Times, and he's the author of Dear Undercover Economist, Priceless Advice on Money, Work, Sex, Kids, and Life's Other Challenges. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montagne.